This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Summer of 69. Written by Ellen Hildebrand. Read by Aaron Bennett. Dedication. This book is for the three people who were with me in the early morning hours of July 17th, 1969. My mother, Sally Hildebrand, who went into labor 4 weeks before her due date. My maternal grandmother, Ruth Hewling, who ran every red light to get my mother to the Boston Hospital for Women. My twin brother, Eric Hildebrand, who I imagine turned to me and said, "Are you ready for this?" Prologue. Fortunate son. When the selective service notice comes for Tiger, Kate's first instinct is to throw it away. Surely this is every American mother's first instinct. Pretend it got lost in the mail. Buy Tiger a few more weeks of freedom before the U.S. Army sends another letter, by which time this god-awful war in Vietnam might be over. Nixon has promised to end it. There were peace talks going on right now in Paris. Les Juan will succumb to the allure of capitalism, or Thieu will be assassinated, and someone with better sense will take over. Frankly, Kate doesn't care if Vietnam succumbs to the communists. She just wants to keep her son safe. When Tiger gets home from his job at the driving school, Kate says, "There's a letter for you on the kitchen table." Tiger seems unconcerned about what it might be. He's whistling, wearing the polyester uniform shirt issued by Walden Pond Driving Academy, with his name stitched on the pocket. Richard. The letter uses that first name, too. It's addressed to Richard Foley, though no one ever calls him anything but Tiger. Tiger says, "I taught a real cutie today, Ma. Name was McGee. That was her first name, which I thought was far out. She's 19, like me, studying to be a dental hygienist. I flashed her my pearly whites, and then I asked her out to dinner for tonight, and she said yes. You'll like her, I bet." Kate busies herself at the sink, arranging daffodils in a vase. She closes her eyes and thinks, "These are the last easy thoughts he'll ever have." And sure enough, a second later he says, "Oh, geez. Oh, wow." He clears his throat. "Ma?" Kate spins around, clutching a handful of daffodils in front of her, like a cross to ward off a vampire. The expression on Tiger's face is part shock, part excitement, part terror. "I got called up," he says. "I'm to report to the Army Recruitment Office in South Boston on April 21st. April 21st is Kate's birthday. She'll be 48 years old. In 48 years, she has been married twice and had 4 children, 3 daughters and a son. She would never say she loves the son the most. She will say only that she loves him differently. It's the fierce, all-consuming love that any mother feels for her child, but with a dash of extra indulgence. Her handsome son, so much like his father, but kind and good." Kate opens her wallet and sets $20 on the table in front of Tiger. "For your date tonight," she says. "Go someplace nice." On April 21st, it's Kate who takes Tiger from Brookline to South Boston. David offered to drive, but Kate wanted to do it alone. "He's my son," she said, and a flicker of astonished pain crossed David's face. They never speak in those terms, her children, meaning not his. And Kate berated herself while at the same time thinking that if David wanted to know what real pain was, he should try being her. Tiger said goodbye to David and his 3 sisters in the driveway. Kate had instructed the girls not to cry. "We don't want him to think he's never coming back," she said. And yet it's this exact fear that's holding Kate hostage, that Tiger will die on foreign soil. He will be shot in the stomach or the head. He will be killed by a grenade. He will drown in a rice paddy. He will burn in a helicopter crash. Kate has seen it night after night on the news. American boys are dying, and what have Kennedy and Johnson, and now Nixon, done? Sent more boys. At the recruitment office, Kate pulls into a line of cars. Ahead of them, kids just like Tiger are hugging their parents, some of them for the last time. Right? It's indisputable that a percentage of the boys right here in South Boston are headed to their deaths. Kate puts the car in park. It's obvious from watching everyone else that this is going to be quick. Tiger grabs his rucksack from the back seat, and Kate gets out of the car and hurries around. She takes a moment to fix Tiger in her eyes. He's 19 years old, 6'2", 180 pounds, and he has let his blonde hair grow over the collar of his shirt, much to the dismay of Kate's mother, Exalta. But the U.S. Army will take care of that pronto. He has clear green eyes, one of them with an elongated pupil like honey dripping off a spoon. Someone said it looked like a tiger eye, which was how he got his nickname. Tiger has a high school diploma and one semester of college at Framingham State. He listens to Led Zeppelin and The Who. He loves fast cars. He dreams of someday racing in the Indy 500. And then, without warning, Kate is sucked back in time. Tiger was born a week past his due date and weighed 9 pounds, 12 ounces. He took his first steps at 10 months old, which is very early, but he was intent on chasing after Blair and Kirby. At age 7, he could name every player on the Red Sox lineup. Ted Williams was his favorite. At age 12, Tiger hit 3 consecutive home runs in his final game of Little League. He was voted class president in 8th grade, and then quickly and wisely lost interest in politics. He took up bowling as a rainy day pastime in Nantucket, and won his first tournament soon after. Then, in high school, there was football. Tiger Foley holds every receiving record at Brookline High School, including total receiving yards, a record coach Bevilacqua predicts will never be broken. He was recruited to play at Penn State, but Tiger didn't want to travel that far from home, and UMass's team wasn't exciting enough. Or at least that's what Tiger claimed. Kate suspects that Tiger just ran out of enthusiasm for the game, or preferred to go out on top, or just really, really disliked the idea of 4 more years of school. Kate would have liked to point out that if Tiger had gone to college, any college, or if he had stayed at Framingham State part-time, he would not be in this position right now. "Don't forget, you promised to check in on McGee," Tiger says. McGee. He's worried about McGee. Tiger and McGee went on their first date the day Tiger got the letter, and they've been inseparable ever since. Privately, Kate thought it was unwise to jump into a relationship only 2 weeks before going to war, but it might have been the distraction he needed. Kate has agreed to check in on McGee, who Tiger says will be very upset that he's gone, but there is no way a girlfriend of 2 weeks will be as upset as the soldier's own mother. A tour of duty is 13 months, not a lifetime. But some of the mothers here outside the recruitment office are unknowingly saying a permanent goodbye, and Kate feels certain she's one of them. The other mothers didn't do the terrible thing that she did. She deserves to be punished. She has enjoyed every happy day of the past 16 years like it was something she borrowed, and now, finally, the time for payback has arrived. Kate had thought it would be a cancer diagnosis or a car accident or a house fire. She never considered that she would lose her son. But here she is. This is her fault. "I love you, Ma," Tiger says. The obvious response to Tiger is, "I love you too." But instead, Kate says, "I'm sorry." She hugs Tiger so tightly that she feels his ribs beneath his spring jacket. "I'm so sorry, baby." Tiger kisses her forehead and doesn't let go of her hand until the last possible second. When he finally goes in, Kate hurriedly gets back into the car. Out the window, She sees Tiger heading for the open door. A gentleman in a brown uniform barks something at him, and Tiger stands up straighter and squares his shoulders. Kate stares at her fingers gripping the steering wheel. She can't bear to watch him disappear. Part 1. June 1969. Both sides now. They are leaving for Nantucket on the third Monday in June, just as they always do. Jesse's maternal grandmother, Exalta Nichols, is a stickler for tradition, and this is especially true when it comes to the routines and rituals of summer. The third Monday in June is Jesse's 13th birthday, which will now be overlooked. That's fine with Jesse. Nothing can be properly celebrated without Tiger anyway. Jessica Levin, rhymes with heaven, she tells people, is the youngest of her mother's four children. Jesse's sister Blair is 24 years old and lives on Commonwealth Avenue. Blair is married to an MIT professor named Angus Whalen. They're expecting their first baby in August, which means that Jesse's mother, Kate, will be returning to Boston to help, leaving Jesse alone with her grandmother on Nantucket. Exalta isn't a warm and fuzzy grandmother who bakes cookies and pinches cheeks. For Jesse, every interaction with Exalta is like falling headlong into a pricker bush. It's not a question of whether she will be stuck, only where and how badly. Jesse has floated the possibility of returning to Boston with Kate, but her mother's response was, "You shouldn't have to interrupt your summer." "It wouldn't be interrupting," Jesse insisted. The truth is, coming back early would mean saving her summer. Jesse's friends Leslie and Doris stay in Brookline and swim at the country club using Leslie's family's membership. Last summer, Leslie and Doris grew closer in Jesse's absence. Their bond made up the sturdiest side of the triangle, leaving Jesse on shaky ground. Leslie is the queen bee among them because she's blonde and pretty, and her parents are occasionally dinner guests of Teddy and Joan Kennedy. Leslie sometimes gives Jesse and Doris the impression that she thinks she's doing them a favor by remaining their friend. She has enough social currency to hang with Pammy Pope and the really popular girls if she wants. With Jesse gone all summer, Leslie might disappear from her life for good. Jesse's next older sister, Kirby, is a junior at Simmons College. Kirby's arguments with their parents are loud and fascinating. Years of eavesdropping on her parents' conversations have led Jesse to understand the main problem. Kirby is a free spirit who doesn't know what's good for her. Kirby changed her major twice at Simmons. Then she tried to create her own major, gender and racial studies, but it was rejected by the dean. And so, Kirby decided she would be the first student ever to graduate from Simmons without a major. Again, the dean said no. He said graduating without a major would be like attending the commencement ceremony in the nude, Kirby told Jesse. And I said he shouldn't tempt me. Jesse can easily imagine her sister striding across the stage to accept her diploma in just her birthday suit. Kirby started participating in political protests while she was still in high school. She marched with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. from Roxbury through the slums and dangerous neighborhoods to Boston Common, where Jesse's father picked Kirby up and took her home. This past year, Kirby marched in two anti-war protests and got arrested both times. Arrested! Jesse's parents are running out of patience with Kirby. Jesse overheard her mother saying, "We aren't giving that girl another dime until she learns to color inside the lines." But Kirby is no longer their biggest concern. Their biggest concern is Jesse's brother, Richard, known to one and all as Tiger, who was drafted into the U.S. Army in April. After basic training, Tiger was deployed to the Central Highlands of Vietnam with Charlie Company of the 12th Regiment of the 3rd Brigade of the 4th Infantry. This situation has rocked the foundation of the family. They'd all believed that only working-class boys went to war, not star receivers from Brookline High School. Everyone at school treated Jesse differently after Tiger was deployed. Pammy Pope invited Jesse to her family's annual Memorial Day picnic. Jesse declined out of loyalty to Leslie and Doris, who hadn't been included. And the guidance counselor, Miss Flowers, pulled Jesse out of class one Monday in early June to see how she was doing. The class was home economics, and Jesse's leaving inspired enormous envy in all the other girls, who were battling with their sewing machines in an attempt to finish their navy corduroy vests before the end of the term. Miss Flowers brought Jesse to her office, closed the door, and made Jesse a cup of hot tea using an electric kettle. Jesse didn't drink hot tea, although she liked coffee. Exalta permitted Jesse one cup of milky coffee at Sunday brunch, despite Kate's protests that it would stunt Jesse's growth. But Jesse enjoyed the escape to the cozy confines of Miss Flowers' office. Miss Flowers had a wooden box filled with exotic teas, chamomile, chicory, jasmine, and Jesse chose a flavor as if her life depended on picking the right one. She decided on hibiscus. The tea was a pale orange color even after the tea bag had steeped for several minutes. Jesse added 3 cubes of sugar, fearing the tea would have no taste otherwise. And she was right. It tasted like orange sugar water. "So," Miss Flowers said, "I understand your brother is overseas. Have you heard from him yet?" "Two letters," Jesse said. One of the letters had been addressed to the entire family and included details of basic training, which Tiger said was not at all as hard as you read about. For me, it was a piece of cake. The other letter had been for Jesse alone. She wasn't sure if Blair and Kirby had gotten their own letters, but Jesse kind of doubted it. Blair, Kirby, and Tiger were all full biological siblings. They were the children of Kate and her first husband, Lieutenant Wilder Foley, who had served along the 38th parallel in Korea and then come home and accidentally shot himself in the head with his Beretta. But Tiger was closest to his half-sister, Jesse. Actually, they weren't allowed to use the terms half-sister, half-brother, and stepfather. Kate flat-out forbade it. But whether or not anyone chose to acknowledge it, the family had a fault line. They were two families stitched together. But the relationship between Tiger and Jesse felt real and whole and good, and what he had said in the letter proved that. The first line, "Dear Messy," made tears stand in Jesse's eyes. "Letters are the only thing that makes it easier," Miss Flowers said, and at that point, her eyes had been brimming as well. Miss Flowers' fiancé, Rex Rothman, had been killed in the Tet Offensive the year before. Miss Flowers had taken a full week off from school, and Jesse saw a photograph of her in the Boston Globe, standing next to a casket draped with the American flag. But when the new school year started in September, a romance seemed to blossom between Miss Flowers and Eric Barstow, the gym teacher. Mr. Barstow was as muscle-bound as Jack LaLanne. The boys both hated and respected Mr. Barstow, and Jesse and the other girls at school had been wary of him, until he started dating Miss Flowers, when he suddenly became a romantic hero. That spring, they spotted him bringing Miss Flowers a delicate bouquet of lilies of the valley wrapped in a wet paper towel, and after school each day, he carried her books and files out to the parking lot. Jesse had seen them together by Miss Flowers' Volkswagen Bug, which was painted the color of a Florida orange, Mr. Barstow leaning an elbow on the roof while they talked. She once saw them kissing as the school bus drove away. Some people, Leslie, for example, are unhappy that Miss Flowers saw fit to replace her dead fiancé within a year. But Jesse understands how losing someone tragically leaves a vacuum, and as they learned in science class, nature abhors a vacuum. Jesse knows that after Wilder died, her mother had hired a lawyer to fight the insurance company's claim that his death was a suicide. The lawyer argued that Wilder had been cleaning the Beretta in his garage workshop, and it had discharged accidentally. This distinction was important not only for life insurance purposes, but also for the peace of mind of Kate's three young children. Blair had been 8, Kirby 5, and Tiger only 3. The lawyer Kate hired, who was successful in convincing the court that the death was accidental, was none other than David Levin. 6 months after the case was settled, Kate and David started dating. They got married, despite Exalta's vehement objections, and a few short months after the courthouse wedding, Kate became pregnant with Jesse. Jesse hadn't wanted to talk to Miss Flowers about Tiger in Vietnam, so to change the subject, she said, "This tea is delicious." Miss Flowers nodded vaguely and dabbed her eyes with the handkerchief she kept tucked into the belt of her dress to offer her students. She was, after all, a guidance counselor for adolescents, and their hormones and feelings ran amok on an hourly basis. She said, "I just want you to know that if you have any dark thoughts during the school day, you can come to talk to me here." Jessie had glanced down into her cup. She knew she would never be able to take Miss Flowers up on this offer. How could Jessie talk about her dark thoughts regarding her brother, who was, as far as she knew, still alive, when Miss Flowers had actually lost Rex Rothman, her fiancé? Jessie was tormented each night by thoughts of Tiger getting killed by mortar shells or grenades or being captured and marched 100 miles through the jungle without any food or water, but she stayed away from Miss Flowers' office. She managed to avoid seeing the guidance counselor alone until the last day of school, when Miss Flowers stopped Jessie on her way out the door and said in her ear, "When I see you in September, your brother will be home safe, and I'll be engaged to Mr. Barstow." Jessie had nodded her head against the rough linen of Miss Flowers' jumper, and when she looked into Miss Flowers' eyes, she saw that she truly believed those words. And for one sterling moment, Jessie believed them too.
June 7th, 1969. Dear Messy, I'm writing a letter now to make sure it reaches you in time for your birthday. They say it only takes a week for mail to reach the States, but when I think about the distance it has to travel, I figured better safe than sorry. Happy birthday, Messy. 13 years old, I can't believe it. I remember when you were born. Actually, all I remember is Gramps taking us for ice cream at Brigham's. I got a double scoop of butter brickle and a sugar cone, and the damn thing fell over, and Gramps said, "Aw, hell," then got me another one. I don't know how much you remember about Gramps. You were pretty young when he croaked, but he was a hell of a guy. Before I shipped over, Nani gave me his class ring from Harvard, but we aren't allowed to wear rings, so I keep it in the front pocket of my flak jacket, which isn't that smart because if I get blown to bits, the ring will be lost forever, but I like to have it next to my heart. It makes me feel safe somehow, which may sound corny, but Messy, you would not believe what counts for a good luck charm around here. Some guys wear crosses or stars of David, some carry rabbit feet. One dude has the key to his girlfriend's bicycle lock. Another guy has an ace of spades that won him a big hand of poker the night before he shipped out. And I have Gramps class ring from Harvard, which I don't advertise because the guys might think I'm trying to boast about my pedigree. But what I guess I'm trying to tell you is that the guys carry things they think have magic powers, or things that remind them why they might like to stay alive. There are a few of us who have proven to be natural-born survivors, which is good, because our company has been dropped right into the action. I've made 2 real friends here in Charlie Company, Frog and Puppy, properly Francis and John. The other guys call us the Zoo because we all have animal nicknames, but they're jealous of how tough we are. The 3 of us have stupid contests, like who can do the most pull-ups on a tree branch, and who can learn the most curse words in Vietnamese, and who can smoke an entire cigarette without taking the damn thing out of his mouth the fastest. Frog is a Negro, gasp, what would Nani think, from Mississippi, and Puppy is so blonde and pale he's nearly albino. We should have called him Casper or Ghost, but those nicknames were already taken by other guys in our regiment, and since he's the youngest in the platoon, he's Puppy. Puppy is from Linden, Washington, all the way up by the Canadian border. Raspberry country, he says. Bushes as far as you can see, all of them growing fat, juicy raspberries. Puppy misses those raspberries, and Frog misses his mama's vinegar coleslaw, and I miss Brigham's butter brickle. So we are a mixed bag, a cross-section of our great country, if you will. I love these guys with all my heart, even though I've known them only a few weeks. The three of us feel invincible. We feel strong. And Messy, I hate to say it, but I know I'm the strongest of the three of us. At first, I thought that was because of Coach Bevilacqua making the team do so many wind sprints and climb all the stairs in the stadium. But that only makes you tough on the outside. And to survive here, you also have to be tough on the inside. When it's your turn to take point when you're charging a position, you have to be brave, and I mean brave, because chances are good you're going to be the first one to encounter Charlie. If you meet up with enemy fire, you're taking the bullet. The first time I led my company, we were headed down this jungle path. The mosquitoes were roaring like lions. It was the dead of night, and a group of VC sneaked up behind us and slit the throat of Ricci, who was bringing up the rear. We engaged in a firefight, and a couple others were shot, Acosta and Kelts. I made it out with nothing but 24 mosquito bites. I hear other units have gotten shrinks to come in and help them deal with the way this stuff messes up your head. When we go out on a mission, it's almost certain that at least one of us is going to die. Which one of us is only a question of luck, like which ducks are you going to hit with your water pistol in a carnival game? When I was teaching kids to drive in Brookline, I knew the war was going on. I watched it on TV with you and Mom and Dad. I heard the body counts, but that didn't feel real. Now I'm here, and it's too real. Every day requires fortitude, which wasn't a word I knew the definition of until I got here. At night, when I'm on watch or I'm trying to fall asleep while also staying alert, I wonder who in the family I'm most like. Whose DNA is going to keep me alive? At first, I thought it must be Gramps, because he was a successful banker. Or my father's, because he was a lieutenant in Korea. But then you know what I realized? The toughest person in our family is Nani. She's probably the toughest person in the entire world. I'd put our grandmother up against any Viet Cong or any one of my commanding officers. You know that way she looks at you when you've disappointed her, like you're not good enough to lick her shoe? Or when she uses that voice and says, "What am I to think of you now, Richard?" Yes, I know you know, and that's why you're dreading going to Nantucket. So if it helps you be less miserable, remember that the qualities of Nani that are making you unhappy are also the qualities that are keeping your favorite brother alive. I love you, Messy. Happy birthday. Tiger. The night before they leave for Nantucket, Jessie and her parents are sitting at the kitchen table sharing pizza out of a delivery box. Kate has been too busy packing to cook when there's a knock on the front door. Jessie, Kate, and David all freeze like they're in a game of statues. An unexpected knock on the door at 7:30 in the evening means all Jessie can picture is two officers standing outside on the step, holding their hats, about to deliver the news that will shatter the family. Kate will never recover. Blair might well go into preterm labor. Kirby will be the most histrionic, and she will loudly blame Robert McNamara, Lyndon Johnson, and her particular nemesis, Richard Milhouse Nixon. And Jessie, what will Jessie do? She can only imagine dissolving like the Alka-Seltzer tablet her father drops in water at night when he's working on a stressful case. She will turn into a fine dust, and then she will blow away. David stands up from the table, his face grim. He isn't Tiger's biological father, but he has filled the role since Tiger was a small boy and, in Jessie's opinion, has done a good job. David is slender. Tennis is his game, which is his only saving grace as far as Exalta is concerned. whereas Tiger is tall with broad shoulders, the image of Lieutenant Wilder Foley. David is a lawyer, though not the kind who shouts in courtrooms. He's calm and measured. He always encourages Jesse to think before she speaks. David and Tiger have a close, nearly tender relationship, so Jesse bets David feels sick as he goes to answer the door. Kate reaches for Jesse's hand and squeezes. Jesse stares at the half a pizza remaining in the box and thinks that if Tiger is dead, none of them will ever be able to eat pizza again, which is too bad because it's Jesse's favorite food. Then she has an even more inappropriate thought. If Tiger is dead, she won't have to go to Nantucket with her mother in Exalta. Her life will be ruined, but her summer will, in one sense, be saved.
Jesse? Her father calls.
He sounds irritated. She stands up from the table and scurries to the front door. David is holding the screen open. Outside, illuminated by the porch light, are Leslie and Doris.
I told your friends we were eating, David says. But since you're leaving tomorrow, I'll give you 5 minutes. They came to say goodbye.
Jesse nods. Thank you, she whispers. She sees the relief on her father's face. Being disrupted during the dinner hour is not good, but the reason for it is far, far better than what they had all privately feared. Jesse steps out onto the porch.
5 minutes, David says,
and he shuts the screen door behind her. Jesse waits for her heart rate to return to normal.
You guys walked? She asks.
Leslie lives 6 blocks away, Doris nearly 10. Doris nods. She looks glum as usual. Her Coke bottle glasses slide to the end of her nose. She's wearing her bell-bottom jeans with the embroidered flowers on the front pockets, of course. Doris lives in those jeans. But as a concession to the heat, she's paired them with a white eyelet halter top that would be pretty if it weren't for the ketchup stain on the front. Doris's father owns 2 McDonald's franchises. She eats a lot of hamburgers. The air is balmy, and among the trees bordering the road, Jesse sees the flash of fireflies. Oh, how she longs to stay in Brookline through the summer. She can ride her bike to the country club with Leslie and Doris, and in the late afternoons, they can buy bomb pops from the Good Humor Man. They can hang out at the shops in Coolidge Corner and pretend they're just bumping into boys from school. Kirby told Jesse that this is the summer boys her age will finally start getting taller.
We came to say bon voyage, Leslie says.
She peers behind Jesse to make sure no one is lingering on the other side of the screen door and then lowers her voice.
Also, I have news.
2 pieces of news, Doris says.
First of all, Leslie says, it came.
It, Jesse repeats, though she knows Leslie means her period. Doris wraps an arm across her own midsection.
I've been feeling crampy, she says, so I suppose I'll be next.
Jesse isn't sure what to say. How should she greet the news that one of her best friends has taken the first step into womanhood, while she, Jesse, remains resolutely a child? Jesse is envious, fiendishly so, because ever since The Talk, led by the school nurse last month, the topic of menstruation has consumed their private conversations. Jesse assumed Leslie would be first among them to get her period, because Leslie is the most developed. She already has small, firm breasts and wears a training bra, whereas Jesse and Doris are as flat as ironing boards. Jesse's envy and longing and, on some days, anxiety, she heard a story about a girl who never got her period at all, is foolish, she knows. Both of Jesse's older sisters moan about their periods. Kirby calls it the curse, which is a fairly apt term in Kirby's case, as the monthly onset gives her migraine headaches and debilitating cramps and puts her in a foul temper. Blair is slightly more delicate when referring to her own cycle, although it's not an issue at the moment because she's pregnant.
Leslie can get pregnant now, Jesse thinks,
a notion that is almost laughable.
She's ready to stop talking about all of this. She wants to go back inside and finish her pizza.
What's the second piece of news? Jessie asks.
This, Leslie says, and she produces a flat, square, wrapped present from behind her back.
Happy birthday.
Oh, Jessie says, stunned. Like everyone else with a summer birthday, she has given up hoping that it will ever be properly celebrated by her classmates. She accepts the gift. It is, quite obviously, a record album.
Thank you.
She beams at Leslie, then at Doris, who is still clutching her abdomen against imaginary cramps, and then she rips the wrapping paper off. It's Clouds by Joni Mitchell, as Jessie hoped it would be. She is obsessed with the song Both Sides Now. It's the most beautiful song in the world. Jessie could listen to it every single second of every day between now and the time she died, and she still wouldn't be sick of it. She hugs Leslie, then Doris, who says, "We split the cost." This statement seems meant to elicit a second thank you, which Jessie delivers more specifically to Doris. Jessie is happy to hear they actually bought the album because, in the 2 weeks since school let out, the three of them have engaged in a spate of shoplifting. Leslie stole 2 pink pencil erasers and 1 package of crayons from Irving's. Doris stole a day-old egg bagel from the kosher bakery, and Jessie, under extreme pressure from the other two, stole a Maybelline mascara from the Woolworths in Coolidge Corner, which was a far riskier crime because Woolworths was said to be wired with hidden cameras. Jessie knows that stealing is wrong, but Leslie turned it into a challenge, and Jessie felt her honor was at stake. When Jessie walked into Woolworths on the day of her turn, she had been afraid, indeed terrified, and was already framing the apology to her parents, already deciding to blame her bad decision-making on the stress of her brother's deployment. But when she walked out of Woolworth's with the mascara tucked safely in the pocket of her orange windbreaker, she felt a rush of adrenaline that she thought must be similar to getting high. She felt great. She felt powerful. She had been so intoxicated that she stopped at the gas station near the corner of Beacon and Harvard, went into the ladies' room, and applied the mascara right then and there in the dingy mirror. The less thrilling part of the story was that Kate detected the mascara the second Jessie walked into the house, and the Spanish Inquisition had followed. What was on Jessie's eyes? Was it mascara? Where did she get mascara? Jessie had given Kate the only believable answer. It was Leslie's. Jessie hoped and prayed that Kate wouldn't call Leslie's mother, because if Leslie's mother asked Leslie about it, it was 50-50 whether Leslie would cover for Jessie or not. All in all, Jessie is relieved not to be receiving a stolen record album. If her mother ever found out about the shoplifting, she would pluck Jessie from Leslie's sphere of influence permanently.
When are you coming back? Leslie asks.
Labor Day, Jessie says. It seems like an eternity from now.
Write me. You still have the address, right?
Yup, Doris says. I already sent you a postcard.
You did?
Jessie says. She's touched by this unexpected act of kindness from grouchy old Doris.
We're gonna miss you, Leslie says.
Jessie hugs the record album to her chest as she waves goodbye and then goes back into the house. She wasn't the first to get her period. She might not even be the second, but that doesn't matter. Her friends love her. They bought her something they knew she wanted. And, more important, her brother is still alive. For one brief moment at the tail end of her 12th year, Jessie Levin is happy. Early in the morning, there is a light rapping on Jessie's bedroom door. Her father pokes his head in.
You up? He asks.
No, she says. She pulls the covers over her head. The floaty feeling from last night has disappeared. Jessie doesn't want to go to Nantucket. It isn't even possible to look at both sides now. There is only one side, which is that without her siblings, and eventually without her mother, Nantucket is going to stink. David eases down onto the bed next to her. He's dressed in his navy summer weight suit, a white shirt, and a wide orange and blue striped tie. His curly dark hair is tamed, and he smells like work, meaning Old Spice aftershave. "Hey," he says, pulling the covers back. "Happy birthday."
"Can't I just stay here with you and go on the weekends?" Jesse says.
"Honey,
please."
"You'll be fine," David says. "You'll be better than fine. Big summer for you. 13 years old. You're finally a teenager, stepping out from the shadow of your siblings."
"I like their shadow," Jesse says.
The summer before, Kate had enlisted each of Jesse's siblings to entertain her every third day. Blair always took Jesse to Cliffside Beach. They got hot dogs and frappes at the galley, and then worked diligently on their copper-tone tans while Blair turned the pages of John Updike's wife-swapping novel, Couples, reading the scandalous sections out loud to Jesse. Updike was fond of the word tumescence, and the first time Blair read the word, she eyed Jesse over the pages and said,
"You know what that means, right?"
"Right," Jesse said, though she hadn't the foggiest. Blair had lowered the book and said,
"There's no reason to be grossed out by sex. It's perfectly natural. Angus and I have sex every single day, sometimes twice."
Jesse had been both intrigued and repulsed by this information, and she hadn't been able to look at Angus the same way after. He was 10 years older than Blair and had dark hair that he never had time to comb because he was too busy thinking. He was always working on math problems, and Nani liked him so much that, while they were staying at All's Fair, she let him sit in Gramps' leather chair at Gramps' antique desk. Angus rarely went to the beach because he hated sand and he burned easily. Jesse didn't relish the thought of Angus's voracious sexual appetite. Blair was beautiful and smart enough to have any man she wanted, but she'd married Angus and given up teaching English at Windsor in order to keep house for him. Now she worshipped Julia Child and wore Lily Pulitzer patio dresses. But on the beach, she was more like a naughty aunt than a matronly older sister. She smoked Kent's, lighting up with a silver lighter from Tiffany that was engraved with a love note from Angus's younger brother, Joey, who had been Blair's boyfriend before Angus. She reapplied her lipstick every time she came out of the water, and she shamelessly flirted with the cliffside lifeguard Marco, who hailed from Rio de Janeiro. Blair spoke a few select phrases in Portuguese. She was glamorous. Kirby also took Jesse to the beach, but she opted for the South Shore, where the surfers and the hippies hung out. Kirby would let some air out of the tires of the fire engine red International Harvester Scout that their grandmother had bought for island driving, and they would cruise right onto Matakisham Beach, where every single sunny day was cause for celebration. People played volleyball and plucked cans of Schlitz out of galvanized tubs of ice, and the air smelled like marijuana smoke. Someone always brought a transistor radio, so they listened to the Beatles and Creedence and Kirby's favorite band, Steppenwolf. In Jesse's opinion, Kirby was even prettier than Blair. Kirby's hair was long and straight, and while Blair was voluptuous, Kirby was thin as a rail. Surfers with wetsuits hanging off their torsos like shed skin would throw Kirby over their shoulders and toss her into the waves. She would scream in protest, but secretly Jesse knew she loved it. And unlike Blair, Kirby didn't care what she looked like when she climbed out of the water. She wore no makeup, and she let her blonde hair dry in the sun, uncombed. She smoked weed instead of cigarettes, but two tokes only when she was watching Jesse. That was her rule. Two tokes mellowed her out, she said, and the effects had always worn off by the time they stepped back into All's Fair. Jesse's days with Tiger were adventures. They rode their bikes to Myokomet Pond to fish. They hiked to Alter Rock, the highest point on Nantucket, and shot off Tiger's potato gun. but their favorite activity was bowling. Tiger was a legend at Mid-Island Bowl and had been since he was 12 years old. All of the locals knew him and spotted him games and bought birch beers for Jesse, which she savored because Exalta didn't tolerate any soda except for ginger ale mixed with grenadine at the club, and even then, Jesse was allowed only one. Tiger's prowess at bowling was surprising because they played the game only on Nantucket and only when it rained. Exalta didn't believe in children staying indoors on beautiful summer days. Once Tiger was old enough to drive, of course, he could bowl whenever he wanted. On days when he minded Jesse, he took her with him, but they kept it from Exalta, which made it an even bigger thrill. When Tiger lined the ball up with the pins and then let the ball sail from his fingers as his back leg lifted behind him, it was like he was dancing. He was graceful, he was strong, and he was accurate. Most of the time, he swept away the pins in their entirety, like he was clearing a table. Jesse had hoped and prayed that his God-given talent would prove to be a genetic trait she shared, but no such luck. Jesse's balls veered to the right or the left, and at least half the time, they dropped into the gutter. Jesse tries to imagine a Nantucket summer without her siblings. She will rattle around All's Fair with her summer reading book, Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl. That is, when she's not at tennis lessons, which her grandmother is insisting on, even though Jesse has less than no interest. Jesse isn't spoiled enough to call the prospect of a summer on Nantucket dreary, but why, oh why, can't she just stay home? Her father, sitting on her bed, pulls a small box out of his jacket pocket.
"Turning 13 is a very big deal in the Jewish tradition," he says. "I had a bar mitzvah, but since we haven't raised you Jewish, we won't be having that kind of ceremony for you."
He pauses, looks away for a moment.
"But I want to acknowledge how important this age is."
Jesse sits up in bed and opens the box. It's a silver chain with a round pendant the size of a quarter. Engraved on the pendant is a tree.
"Tree of life," David says. "In the Kabbalah, the tree of life is a symbol of responsibility and maturity."
The necklace is pretty, and Jesse loves her father more than she loves anyone, even Tiger, though she knows love can't be quantified. She feels protective of her father because, while Jesse is related to everyone in the family, David is related by blood to no one but her. She wonders if he ever thinks about this and feels like an outsider. She loves that her father has chosen to acknowledge this bond between them. She has heard that to be considered a real Jew, one's mother must be Jewish. And if that was true, Jesse wouldn't qualify. But she feels a connection to her father. Something spiritual. Something bigger than just regular love. When she secures the clasp and lets the cool weight of the charm rest against her breastbone. She wonders if Anne Frank owned a Tree of Life necklace, then decides that if she did, she probably hid it with the rest of her family's valuables so the Nazis wouldn't take it.
"Thank you, Daddy," she says.
He smiles. "I'm going to miss you, kiddo, but I'll see you on weekends."
"I guess since I'm supposed to be responsible and mature now, I have to stop complaining about going away," Jesse says.
"Yes, please," David says. "And I'll tell you what. When I come to the island, we'll walk to the sweet shop, get you a double scoop of malachite chip, and you can complain about your grandmother for as long as you want. Deal?"
"Deal," Jesse says.
And for one brief moment at the beginning of her 13th year, Jesse Levin is happy. Born to be Wild. The conversation isn't going well, but that's hardly unusual for a 21-year-old woman talking to her parents in the summer of 1969.
"I need some space to breathe," Kirby says. "I need some air under my wings. I'm an adult. I should be able to make my own choices."
"You can call yourself an adult and make your own choices when you're paying to support yourself," David says.
I told you, Kirby says. I found a job. And I won't be far. One island away.
Absolutely not, Kate says. You've been arrested twice. Arrested, Catherine.
Kirby cringes. Her mother only breaks out Kirby's first name when she wants to sound stern. But not thrown in jail.
But fined, David says.
For no reason, Kirby says. It's like the Boston police never heard of freedom of assembly.
You must have done something to provoke the officer, David says. Something you're not telling us.
Well, yes, Kirby thinks. Obviously. And we've had to lie to your grandmother, Kate says. If she finds out you've been arrested twice, she'll...
Take away my trust fund, Kirby says. I think we all know she can't do that.
Kirby will be given control of her trust fund when she graduates from college or when she turns 25, whichever comes first. This has been her sole motivation for staying enrolled at Simmons.
David sighs. What's the job?
Kirby gives them a victorious smile.
I'll be working as a chambermaid at the Shiretown Inn in Edgartown.
A chambermaid? Kate says.
You can't even clean your own room, David says.
Now you're exaggerating, Kirby says. She decides to stick with eagerness and enthusiasm because she knows this will be more persuasive than anger and indignation.
Listen, I realize I've never held a job before, but that's because I've spent all my spare time on my causes.
We've spent all our spare time on your causes, Kate says, with a barely concealed eye roll.
Dad has, Kirby says. Remember when I was in high school? You didn't even want me to march with Dr. King. You told me I was too young.
You were too young, Kate says.
What you meant was that I was too white, Kirby says.
Don't put words in my mouth, young lady.
No one will ever march with Dr. King again, Kirby says. So that memory is officially priceless, and you nearly kept me from having it. I was with Miss Carpenter the entire time. Nothing bad was going to happen. It was a peaceful protest. That was the point. The anti-war protests this spring were different because the country is different now. Students like me are the enemy of the establishment. But you should both be happy I'm thinking for myself and not just falling in line.
Kirby pauses. She sees David softening a bit, but her mother remains rigid.
I want to get a job this summer. And after I graduate, I'm going to pursue a career. I want to be more than just a wife and mother. I don't want to end up like Blair.
Watch it, Kate says. Being a mother is a blessing.
But you have to admit.
Kirby stops herself before she shares an ungenerous opinion about her older sister. Blair and Kirby have long been described as the overachiever and the underachiever, respectively. Okay, no one has ever said that out loud, but Kirby knows people think it. Blair scored straight A's all through high school and went to Wellesley College, where she made the dean's list every single term. She won the English department's award for outstanding student, and her thesis about Edith Wharton received some sort of special distinction from a panel made up of professors from all the seven sister schools. Blair had gotten a job teaching the top-tier senior girls at the Windsor School, a position that opened up approximately once every 50 years. From there, it would have been a short hop to a graduate degree and becoming a professor. But what had Blair done? Married Angus, quit the job, and gotten pregnant.
Admit what? Kate asks.
That Blair's a disappointment, Kirby thinks. But that's not true. The person who's a disappointment is Kirby herself. Kirby is tempted to come clean with her parents, to tell them she has just endured the worst 3 months of her life, both physically and emotionally. She needs to wipe away the memory of the protests, the arrests, her love affair with Officer Scott Turbo, the trip to Lake Winnipesaukee. She had been dealt a losing hand of fear, anxiety, heartbreak, and shame. She needs a fresh start. She appeals to David, who has always been more compassionate than her mother.
I'm bombing in my classes at Simmons because they're boring.
I don't want to study library science, and I don't want to teach nursery school.
You want to clean hotel rooms? He asks.
I want to work, Kirby says. And that was the job I happened to nail down.
Here, she casts her eyes to the floor because she's not being 100% truthful.
You don't know anyone on Martha's Vineyard, Kate says. We're Nantucket people. You, me, Nani, Nani's mother, Nani's grandmother. You're a fifth-generation Nantucketer, Catherine.
It's that kind of us-and-them attitude that's destroying our country, Kirby says. When David laughs, Kirby realizes she's going to get her way.
Spending the summer somewhere else will be educational.
Do you remember my friend Rajani from school?
Her parents have a house in Oak Bluffs, and they said I can stay with them.
Stay with Rajani's family all summer? David says. That sounds excessive.
He turns to Kate.
Doesn't it? Rajani's family shouldn't have to shelter and feed our daughter.
Correct, Kate says. She should come to Nantucket, where she belongs.
There's also a house a few blocks from Rajani's that I found in the classifieds. 6 bedrooms to let, college girls preferred. $150 for the summer.
That makes more sense, David says. We can pay the rent, but your day-to-day living expenses will be up to you.
Oh, thank you, Kirby says.
Kate throws up her hands.
Kirby and her best friend from Simmons, Rajani Patel, drive to Woods Hole in Rajani's maroon MG with the top down. Kirby secured a room in the house on Narragansett Avenue for the summer. She gave her parents the phone number and the name of the proprietress, Miss Alice O'Rourke.
I suppose she's Irish Catholic, David had remarked. Let's hope she runs a tight ship.
When Rajani and Kirby drive the MG off the ferry into Oak Bluffs, Kirby brings her palms together in front of her heart in a gesture of gratitude. She is starting over on her own, somewhere completely new.
Well, okay, maybe not completely new. She's still on an island off the coast of Cape Cod. As the crow flies, she's only 11 miles away from Nantucket. She could have gone to inner-city Philadelphia to work with disadvantaged youth. She could be driving around rural Alabama, registering people to vote. So this is just a first step, but it will be good for her.
Rajani is excited to play tour guide.
There's Ocean Park,
she says about a large expanse of green lawn with a white gazebo at its navel.
And to the left are the Flying Horses Carousel and the Strand Movie Theater.
Kirby swivels her head, trying to take it all in. The town has a carnival feel. It's a bit more honky-tonk than Kirby expected. She eyes the carousel, which Rajani has informed Kirby is the nation's oldest operating platform carousel, and then turns her attention to the people on the sidewalks, eating fried clams out of red and white checkered cardboard boats and swirling their tongues around soft-serve ice cream cones. The town does offer the diversity Rajani promised, which is refreshing. A black teenager glides by on a unicycle. Somewhere, there's a radio playing the fifth dimension. This is the dawning of the Age of Aquarius. Kirby bobs her head along to the music. This is the dawning of something for Kirby as well. But what?
We live in the Methodist campground, Rajani says,
and Kirby tries not to grimace. The only thing she can think of that's less appealing than living in a campground is living in a religious campground. But the campground turns out to be a neighborhood of homes painted the colors of Easter eggs, each house decorated with elaborate gingerbread trim.
That one's mine.
Rajani points to a lavender home with a sharp triangular gable over the front door. The white fretwork drips from the eaves like icing on a fancy cake. The house is straight out of a fairy tale, especially when compared with the architecture of downtown Nantucket, where every house resembles a Quaker widow.
Look at that blue one, Kirby says.
The blue house down the street is a showstopper.
It's nearly twice as big as Rajani's, with 2 gables over a gracious front porch that has a bench swing and a row of ferns in hanging baskets. There were blue hydrangea bushes on either side of the front walk, and the gingerbread trim all around is fashioned to look like icicles. Or at least that's how it seems to Kirby.
"That's my friend Darren's house," Rajani says. "He's going to be a senior at Harvard. Do you want to go see if he's home?"
"We don't have to," Kirby says.
"Come on," Rajani says. "You want to meet people, right?"
"I don't see his car, but it might be in the garage. His parents are really nice. His mother is a doctor, and his father's a judge."
A doctor and a judge. Harvard. All Kirby can think is how happy both Nani and her mother would be. She's meeting the right kind of people, just like on Nantucket, where everyone is a judge or a doctor or holds an endowed chair of effortless superiority at well-bred university.
"Okay," Kirby says. She'll write her mother a postcard later, she decides, and mention all the esteemed people she's met on Martha's Vineyard. "Let's go say hi." Rajani strides up the walk and jabs the doorbell. Kirby wonders about Darren from Harvard. It would be nice to have a summer romance, a romance where she, Kirby, calls the shots instead of being an emotional wreck. It would be nice to stop thinking about Officer Scotty Turbo, with his devastating green eyes and his geisha girl tattoo and his powerful hands that could pin both her wrists over her head as he kissed the spot just below her left ear. A black woman in a white tennis dress opens the door. Her arms have sculpted muscles, and there's a sheen of perspiration on her forehead. Her hair is in a ponytail, and she's wearing diamond earrings. She looks at both girls, women, but her gaze settles on Rajani, and she smiles.
"Rajani," she says, "now the summer can officially begin."
Kirby is initially confused. She thinks, maid? Housekeeper? In a tennis dress and diamond earrings? And then, one instant later, she's mortified by her own obtuseness and, let's just say it, bigotry. This woman must be Darren's mother, the doctor. Darren's mother holds open the screen door. Rajani steps inside and Kirby follows. The house is bright, summery, and modern. A peek in the living room to the right reveals a navy and white striped divan with bright yellow throw pillows and a white coffee table shaped like a kidney bean. Kirby loves it. There isn't a piece of furniture in Nani's house that's less than 100 years old.
"Dr. Fraser," Rajani says, "meet my friend Kirby Foley."
Dr. Fraser offers her hand.
"Nice to meet you, Kirby."
She studies Kirby for a second longer than she might have, or is Kirby just being paranoid? Kirby looks respectable, she thinks, in a strawberry print wrap skirt, a white scoop neck tee, and a pair of Dr. Scholl's. She abandoned her usual mini dresses, peasant blouses, and cut-off jeans in favor of this outfit because she wanted to make a good impression with her landlady, Miss O'Rourke. She senses hesitation on Dr. Fraser's face. Is it because Kirby is white? Should Kirby inform Dr. Fraser that she's a civil rights activist and a feminist? That she marched with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. next to her beloved high school civics teacher, Miss Carpenter? And that she personally defended Miss Carpenter against the racial slurs of the ignorant boys in her class? Should she show Dr. Fraser her National Organization for Women membership card? Should she mention that she's read Simone de Beauvoir, Aimé Césaire, and Eldridge Cleaver? All of that would sound like bragging, she fears, or worse, like she's trying to appropriate African-American struggle for rights and respect when anyone can see that she's as white as Wonder Bread. Besides, it's exaggerating a bit. She has read Aimé Césaire, but she barely understood a single word. She decides the best defense is genuine human warmth. She smiles at Dr. Fraser, and as she does, she realizes she has seen this woman before. But where? Dr. Fraser doesn't work at Simmons, and yet somewhere, Kirby has met her somewhere.
"Are you here visiting for a few days?" Dr. Fraser asks. "Or for the summer?"
"The summer," Kirby says, hoping this will be a point in her favor. "I'm renting a room from Alice O'Rourke. I'll be working as a chambermaid at the Shiretown Inn in Edgartown." Chambermaid? Dr. Fraser asks. She gives Kirby the once-over with what appears to be an incredulous eye. Where are you from, Kirby?
Kirby clears her throat.
My parents live in Brookline.
She's so nervous, she sounds like she's asking the question instead of answering it.
Kirby normally spends her summers on Nantucket, Rajani announces, but she's decided to give the vineyard a whirl.
Brookline and Nantucket, Dr. Fraser says. And you're cleaning rooms in the Shiretown Inn? And you've signed on to live in Alice O'Rourke's house? Do your parents know about this?
She sounds either disapproving or amused. Kirby can't tell which. It feels like Darren's mother has the whole situation figured out. Rich white girl trying on a working class hat for kicks. Kirby doesn't need the chambermaid job. In fact, she's taking it away from someone who does need it. Or maybe Dr. Fraser thinks Kirby has been cast out by her family for one transgression or another. And then Kirby realizes where she knows Dr. Fraser from. Her face grows hot and stiff like she's gotten a bad sunburn, and the back of her throat starts to close. She needs to get out of there pronto. But before Kirby can think of a way to excuse herself, Rajani speaks up.
We came to say hello to Darren. Is he around?
He went to Larson's with his father to pick up lobsters for dinner, Dr. Fraser says. With all the traffic up island, I can't say how long they'll be.
No problem, Rajani says. We'll come back another time.
Well, Dr. Fraser says. She hesitates, and Kirby is pretty sure she's debating whether or not to invite them to stay and wait for Darren. If so, she decides against it.
It was good to see you, Rajani. And nice to meet you, Kirby.
Enjoy our island. She holds the front screen door open, almost as if she's eager for Kirby to get out. She knows who I am, Kirby thinks, and her dream of a fresh start with a clean slate here on Martha's Vineyard vanishes in a snap. Fly me to the moon. People throw around the phrase married with children like loose change, Blair thinks. No one ever talks about the drama that matrimony and parenthood entail. So is it any wonder Blair was taken by surprise? Blair met Angus Whalen, a professor of astrophysics at MIT, because she was dating his younger brother, Joey. Blair had just graduated from Wellesley, and Joey from Boston College. Blair was teaching honors English and the art of the novel to senior girls at the Windsor School. Joey wanted to move to New York City and get into business, but for the time being, he was captaining one of the Swan